Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. A good story is a good story, but how you tell it is what makes it come alive, and what medium you use is where the craft comes in. Well, Nwabisa Plaiki's medium of choice is theatre. From Ugie in the Eastern Cape and a graduate in theatre and performance from the University of Cape Town, Nwabisa is currently curator and coordinator of the Baxter's Masambe Theatre. She's also a playwright or theatre maker. We'll discover exactly what that is in a minute. But interestingly, she's been quoted as saying, "I come from a people that mend broken walls." So who are these people and how did this heritage influence her career? Well, there's clearly a whole lot to find out. So lovely to have you with us, Nwabisa.
Thank you for having me, Nancy.
You know, before we unpack any of that, I know that 4 months ago you gave birth to a baby girl.
Yes.
Who has the most wonderful name.
We've named her Luna and Ziana. Luna, before I found out I was pregnant, I kept seeing a full moon. And it fascinated me. Why am I seeing a full moon almost every day? Then I found out I was pregnant and I got the expected date of delivery. And on that particular day, there was going to be a special eclipse. So I decided Luna was the most appropriate for moon goddess. And then Ziana was sort of like a pouring forth of blessings. And it means that. It means it's a closer word meaning a pouring forth of blessing. Can be associated with Iana, which refers to rain, meaning rain is pouring.
Wow, what a doubly blessed little girl she's going to be with those names. So let's go back to your roots. You grew up in Ugie. Do you want to tell us about Ugie and growing up there and your people who mend broken walls?
I grew up between Ugie and Gala. Gala is where my grandmother was. Ugie is where my mother and my father were. And I did my entire schooling from preschool to grade 12 in Ugie. Weekends were spent in Gala. So it often feels like I'm a person that comes from both these places. When I speak about people who mend broken walls, and I was referring to my family. I mean, they are people who use storytelling to navigate daily problems, to entertain. I think for the longest time, we did not have electricity. We listened to radio stories, but also my grandfather only switched on the radio when there's the news hour. So there's news every hour. But at 7, I remember specifically 7 p.m., we would ask her to keep it longer, you know, so that when news ends at 10 past, at quarter past 7, on Umhlobo Wenene, the evening story would begin. And later they started incorporating the 1 o'clock slot for radio stories. You know, if I was not listening to those stories, then the only way that we entertained each other, you know, was through storytelling. And I mean, I was not the one telling the stories. My aunts, my grandmother, even my grandfather has stories. And I've also seen how when there's a problem or, you know, when there's conflict, how humor and storytelling is often used to solve those issues. And I know even when I was angry as a child, you know, one of the things that my grandmother used to say was, "You can't tell a story angry." And it would be said across my cousins, you know, she would reprimand you about something. And then we would know that there's no electricity. At some point, we have to communicate. And you not participating in that story because of your, you know, because you're angry, still maintaining the anger. So now you can't laugh at the stories. You can't continue the story. You can't even enjoy it properly because you have to maintain that anger. And so I think it was drilled in that you need to let the anger go so that you can experience what is happening at this moment.
It sounds like storytelling is a little bit like a therapy.
So, yeah.
But the content of those stories that your grandmother, your aunts told, and later that you told, what was it?
Sometimes it was past experiences. My family can talk about their poverty and analyze it and how things have changed over time. In the same way that I can say I grew up in a home where for the longest time we didn't have electricity, but then electricity came, you know, and my grandmother was an entrepreneur. So we got to see how as a family we were improving our lives. So a whole lot of it is really reflection on what we come back from, what we used to eat. And I think from my aunts, you know, one of my favorite stories at home, my grandmother has 7 kids. So it's 6 women and 1 male. One of the stories that I enjoyed was how the females used to mark their territory in spaces. So one of my aunts used to fight with boys only, and it's one of the stories that I enjoyed. And apparently, she didn't stop until she won a fight. So if a guy beat her at school, she would want to fight all the time. Even if she met him in town, the fight would have to begin so that she wins the fight. You know, and now they're trying to tell us that fighting is not important, but what's important is that you need to fight for what you believe in. And sometimes you don't even know why people are fighting or, you know, being bullied and trying to navigate yourself through that. So from a very young age, I was taught to fight for yourself and what you believe in, and don't be intimidated by others. I think essentially that was it. I know my cousins, my older cousins, told Cinderella versions, Xhosa Cinderella versions. And so their storytelling was really, when I read storybooks of children, I can be like, oh no, I remember the story, but I remember a Xhosa version of it. Other storytelling just depended on workplaces and trying to get money, and it was really different things depending on who was telling the story.
So it sounds like there were stories that came from their head. They weren't sort of mythical stories necessarily about, you know, sea monsters or water snakes or anything like that. These were stories
it was
sort of created daily life.
Out of daily life. I mean, when my cousins were telling the younger ones, we focused on the mythical things. But I think from the older people in my family, it was really how they can take something out of the ordinary and engages in how they experienced it.
So there was, one way or another, there was a great deal of story, words.
There was a great deal of story.
In your childhood, so you had the stories, you had the radio stories, you had the relations stories.
But I also had, there's a storytelling game that I particularly enjoyed called Isiqendu, where you gather stones, and then you group these stones into different families. And then you start telling a story about these stones and you start impersonating the different characters. But I think that for me, you know, was really the introduction of storytelling. And it's also when I started, you know, loving stones. Mm. But for me, it was really mapping. I think I was mapping as a child what was happening. It was a way of reflecting. It was a way of analyzing. So storytelling has been so central for me that even when I have to make decisions, I have to plot it through story and see, okay, if it was a play, how would I solve this problem?
Hang on, you've just done a great big jump there. You've moved into the third act and I'm still in the wings here. I'm fascinated by the idea of using stones as props to sort of create the story. And I if I'm not wrong, you made a play about that. Hold that thought. Because I want to go back to you that being at home and Yugi and these stories. Because other than the radio, I don't think there was any sort of theatre that you saw as such. But you did do drama at school. And I think that could have been the pathway into what you're doing now. Explain the journey.
So there wasn't really representations of what theatre looks like. I didn't know what it looks like, but there was drama at school. There were no community groups, but I think the support that I got from drama teachers was you imagined the potential. But I think that's also what gave me the freedom. Because when I came in and I saw these different images of what theatre could be, I also started to explore what I thought it was. Because for the longest time, I was like, this is my theater. This is the way I think it should look. It's a disadvantage, but it's also an advantage in the sense that the identity of my work wasn't influenced by things that I could see. That only came much later, where you start borrowing from few theater directors and you're like, I like that particular style, to figure it out on your own.
So I'm not sure at what point you went to University of Cape Town to study theatre and
2011.
Perform. So that was 2011. So that was nine long
2012,
years.
2012. Okay. 2011, I was doing grade 12.
So 2012, you went to UCT. That must have been a huge, given that your theatre had previously been Stones and the home ground, as it were. You were discovering all sorts of theatre, that there's been worlds and centuries of theatre. How did that feel? Was it wonderful or overwhelming? Or,
I mean, I've always been curious and I've always wanted to seem like the know-it-all type of thing. So because I had drama as a subject, I started Googling all these old white men who had developed theory. So I remember coming to UCT and I remember Jackie Singer and Sarah Matchett being surprised by this child from a place they didn't know who knew Grotowski. So I knew the names and I knew the theories. I just didn't have an image for them. So to come in and say, this person is exploring this particular person, you know, I was like, okay, now, you know, all of these things I've been reading, that's how a Brachten work sort of looks like. So a whole lot of things started making sense. I think I started mapping. I started putting everything that I had been reading and researching. I started having images for it. And it was exciting. And I started looking for, you know, if I read about someone and I hadn't seen the work, I started to think, you know, where can I find work like that?
And theatre itself is such a, it's an, you know, people say, I want to go into the theatre. There's so many things. I mean, I said I called you a playwright and you prefer the term theatre maker. But when you were studying, there are so many different aspects of theatre. You could have gone into set design, sound, acting, production, directing, etc. Which one of those avenues did you decide to go into?
I decided to go into acting initially. And I want to speak a little bit about that. Mm. It has to do with the fact that I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something that had to do with storytelling. But the only thing, or I thought the only way to get to do that was to become an actor. And it has to do with how drama is unpacked, even at high school, the career. You don't necessarily, there isn't enough on information packs. I think our industry is not formalized enough so that if you come from a small town, you know all of these different careers within the industry. It was only when I came in that I started to see the different careers. I remember when I auditioned, even in my audition form, I had indicated that I want to become an actor, but I had prepared two monologues. One was a monologue I had chosen and one I had written myself. And so Jackie asked, why don't you choose theater making? And I asked, what is that? And she said, but you wrote work. So it's where people create their own work. You'll also do the other part of performing in works created by other people, but you also get the opportunity to do your own work. So that sounded exciting for me. And I said, sure, definitely, I want to do that. And the more time I spent in university, the more I saw there's an array of career possibilities. And even when I went out of university, now I'm realizing that there's so much. But you walk in there and the only thing you're thinking is, I want to become an actor. So I've watched my journey evolve over time.
Yes, I suppose becoming an actor is sort of the end product. But the theatre making, exactly as it sounds, is from writing the story, writing the script, to developing it, to seeing what it could look like on stage, all those things. So that's part of the whole package. At some point you went to the Magnet Theatre, which is a nursery. It's an absolute breeding ground, isn't it? It's a wonderful place.
Wonderful place.
What were you doing there and what was the experience like?
So Magnet Theatre developed an internship program where they were going to mentor two theatre makers to create two new South African works, one for young people and one for early years, like 3 to 7, or theatre for the very young. And I was fortunate enough to be part of that too. And going to Magnet was life-changing. And I think it made me very ambitious about the industry. And it's the one thing that keeps driving me forward. You know, when you graduate out of drama school, you don't know, or often you don't know what's going to happen next. When you graduate as an actor, it sometimes feels like there's a path. Get an agent, you're going to be called to auditions. And you audition or you go to castings and then you get a job. But as a theater maker, I wasn't sure what will happen because, you know, I'm not familiar with agents that take in theater makers who are not interested in acting. So, you know, to have something that was going to be like a job was mind-blowing for me. I was coming straight out of varsity. My parents had told me that this is not a career, you know, but because you're passionate about it, cool, do it. And immediately, I knew that when I graduate, I had a place to go to and I was going to get paid monthly. So that was absolutely mind-blowing for me and I wish it for everyone. Secondly, Magnet, I was not only a beneficiary. I think the program was so brilliant that coming in, you are not just a beneficiary, but also you are a participant. You are involved in tailoring this thing that you're going to learn and in running it and implementing it. So, and I think the one thing that besides the mentorship that you are getting. On the other hand, you are learning to become a leader. You are learning to become independent, to find your own funding, to make sure that you can run your own career. And it's good to be a beneficiary because you can create work. But I saw a program that where I was not only the beneficiary, but also I was a collaborator. And being there sort of made me aware that I can also develop some sort of training because I could teach. I could learn with all the trainees that were there. I could teach and I was also directing work. So it sort of like opened my brain towards the possibilities that existed for me.
Sounds like it was a very practical add-on to whatever you'd learned at university. This was a real practical immersion into what it meant.
Yes.
Which is probably, I'm assuming, what made you such good material for the job that you're in at the moment. Curator and coordinator of the Baxter's Masambe Theatre. Mm. And you've been there for how long?
This is the third year. So when I spoke to the Baxter CEO, I spoke about a space. I remember the proposal was young people, young theatre makers need a space where they can explore work and not worry about rent. And I found that there were a few places where you can go. And I know Theatre Arts Admin supports, and I've also been a beneficiary there. But I was like, I wanted this space to focus on just being available year-round. And on top of that, I wanted the space to mentor wherever it could. And to offer growth potential. If the work was great, then Laura must see it and we must find a way of developing further. But beyond just being a platform for sharing this work, I wanted young theatre makers and artists to know that there's a space where they can create work. Doesn't matter if you showcase it or not, just so that you have a product that you can work with.
Sort of like a laboratory. So, I mean,
yes.
If they were art students, it would be a studio for them to go and paint in or sculpt in, whatever.
Yeah.
I just want to come back to the storytelling because your medium now, your chosen medium of storytelling is the theatre. But we haven't really talked about the story, the type of stories that you want to tell. And you've had three plays. I think you've done three of your own plays. Do you want to give us a thumbnail sketch of each one?
So I'm thinking, I think I've done more than
let's start with the first one that you were starting to describe.
So the first play that I did was called Identity-Reaching, and it was at the Rosebank Theatre. I think my storytelling depends on my experience at that particular moment. So Identity-Reaching, I explored the use of indigenous languages in higher learning institutions. And I explored just the cultural shock. You know, as much as it wasn't a shock to learn everything that I learned about theatre and I was excited, there was a cultural shock that happened when I came to Cape Town, and now I had to speak English all the time now. So I started that play, really explored language and how it shapes identity.
Can I stop you there? When you say it was a cultural shock, was it a loss? Were you in mourning for your language?
I wasn't. I really wasn't. But it's just that at first I was shocked that I had to speak so much English. And then I went home and I realized that I was slowly losing parts of my language. There were things that I no longer could articulate in isiXhosa, but could articulate in English. And I had to correct that. I had to be like, okay, you are on autopilot there because you're starting to think in a particular way. And it's important for me that when I go home, I can still speak my language. And I think at UCT, I also met people. I made friends with people who had disinherited their mother tongue. And I could feel that loss. I don't want to say I felt sorry for them. That's not the right word. But certainly I felt it isn't right. I don't want that for myself.
Mm. I interrupted your flow of thought there. So Identity-Reaching?
Identity-Reaching. So it really was from hemorrhaging, you know, an overflow of blood. But it was like when you have an overflow of identities. Because I realized that Cape Town has its identity. And when I go home, there's a different Nwabisa. So it was like, what does it feel like to have these identities living inside you, where in a different space, another aspect of yourself comes up? You know, and at that time, I was in a moment where you can start building a hybrid person with all of these identities. And that play merely looked at the changes in identity that happen in different spaces just because you're speaking a different language.
Gosh, that was quite a play that I can imagine would resonate for a huge number of people.
Definitely.
Coming from anywhere.
Definitely.
And coming into the cities.
People are still asking for it. I think it's one of those plays that people still stop me about, and they're like, that play with a difficult name.
Maybe it should get onto the school curriculum. we'll work on that. And then there were another. There was
then
a play
I went
called
to Aha. Aha was for 3 to 7 year olds, and I think that one is my favorite play. It was playing. We were in a room with wool, and the play explores what wool can do. And you start working with wool. There are no words. There's just, you know, singing and just exploring with this wool, how messy it can get, the shapes that it can create, the games that you can play with wool. You're merely exploring wool. And I think that play has been, I mean, the play introduced me to international touring. I can now produce my own work, and I'm now confident in collaborating with international companies and bringing work to or touring work because of Aha.
Yes, because it would be, if there are no words, it would be a universal language. A bit like using emojis in writing. So you could take that anywhere, which solves so many.
Anywhere. And, you know, children enjoy it. But also I found that adults also enjoy it a lot. And I felt the most free in that work.
There was a third play, 23 years.
23 years.
45 seconds,
yes, 2 minutes. 23 years, a month and 7 days. 23 really looked at my participation at the 2015 Roads Must Fall, Fees Must Fall protests. I started reflecting on what we were asking of each other as young people in the country and really looking at the consequences of the choices that we took. It's one of those things that I keep comparing it with the play that my peers created, The Fall. The Fall really looked at what Roads Must Fall as a collective and Fees Must Fall, what they've tried to do and the challenges that we faced, you know, as young people. So I think it really captured that period for the experience of a group. And how 23 was different is that it looked at the individual within that space, the internal conflicts that you have. Do I participate? Do I not participate? And I think it captures 2015 in a very beautiful way, in a way that prioritizes the individual within protest settings.
Has that been your last play? Have there been others?
Mm-mm. Then I went to do my master's and I created. So I've created 2 plays now. There's others that I've written, but they haven't been performed. So I'm not going to talk about those ones. I'm just going to talk about the ones that have been performed. Kalanga Blues, I created for my MA, and I realized that I was spending a whole lot of time looking for opportunities. When I say, you know, the stories that I create or the theater that I create depends on what I'm going through at that particular moment. So I reached a point in 2017, 2018, I realized that I was spending a lot of time searching for opportunities rather than creating work. Then I created a play about that. That play was about process. That play is about pitching for funding, reaching for funding deadlines. It's about administration. And it's exciting for me because I realize that this too can be very interesting and very metaphorical, and we can play, you know, so that I don't feel like I'm wasting my time when I'm writing a budget. It can actually be content for a play. And I think it was, okay, I said Aha is my favorite play, but I think that one just opened, I can see that now I can create a play about anything. But also Kalanga Blues looked at, Kalanga Blues is the name of a soccer team in Cala. And Kalanga Blues feels like they were cheated by Umtata Bushbucks from entering the La Liga. And that discouraged a whole lot of soccer players from playing soccer because they felt like they'll be exploited. And so I looked at that and I looked at how that particular story, you know, resonates with me, certainly with a whole lot of artists who may feel my work was stolen from me by this particular institution. The story sort of like resonated with some of the things that I've heard, this aspect of being cheated, this aspect of wanting to own your own work, or this aspect of, you know, being trained and then not benefiting from your work, or talent being abused by people that have power. And so that was what I was thinking about at that particular period. Because people love Kalanga Blues, I thought about bringing it back, but then I realized I don't want it to have a run. I don't want it to have a 2-week run. I'd rather be it a play, because it also has it's very entertaining, it's very funny, but it's also very depressing, because it makes an account, again, the things that influence me. So after the radio stories, going back, I hope I don't confuse you, when I listen to radio stories, so 7 News, 7:15 was the story. It ended at 7:30. Mhlobonene, and then at 7:30, there was a period in Mhlobonene where they start announcing deaths, who had passed away, when they were going to be buried. And of course, all the people love to listen to this because that's the only way you'd start finding out who passed away in a different town where you, so that you can go to the funeral. So this play also has that aspect. Only difference is that it lists all the graduates who graduate and get training and get, and then they become a salesperson, or they become an ambulance driver, or they become a teacher. It's all these artists that we are losing to other professions, and it moans them. Only because, you know, our career is not formalized enough. There's not enough opportunities for all of us. There's not. And the process to get all of those things is tiring. We don't have time to do the work. So it really allows an artist to reflect, but also to celebrate the fact that even within that, sometimes we can continue making the work, even if the work is about our pain. And so I imagine that play being followed by workshops, intensive workshops, around formalizing our careers, about developing an entrepreneurial mindset. I don't see it as us watching it as artists and then leaving. It just feels like it calls for responsibility.
You know, everything you say seems to add up to this collection of plays that is very much to do with life. It's not about, you know, perhaps in the old days there was a play about, I don't know, death of a salesman or whatever it would be, you know, some classic play that was a story that was nothing to do with anything at all that you might know about, or it might be. But it looks like you're looking at sort of moments, in, as you say, in your life. But it's a way of bringing other people's lived experiences and putting it onto a stage as opposed to being in a book or on a radio. So what is your intention with what you're doing now?
With what I'm doing now?
Yes.
I think right now my focus is really on developing an entrepreneurial mindset in theatre makers, actors, dancers. For me, I think it doesn't matter where you come from. You can pursue a career in theatre. Secondly, I think there's enough training programs. Maybe not enough, but I think there are training programs where you can be taught about the craft, particularly if you're in the Western Cape. I can mourn about Eastern Cape and, you know, community groups, festivals. But when I'm in Cape Town, where I am currently, I can be like, there's Magnet, there's the different festivals, there's, you know, your culture gangs, there's your Zabalaza festivals. And then the small communities themselves have art groups where you can be taught how to create this art. So I think within the Western Cape, that opportunity exists for a whole lot of people. And if you're in Eastern Cape, I don't mourn a lot because I'm like, even if I did not get it, I was still able to create work. But what frustrates me is this: you get this training, you can create this craft, but you don't know how to make a living out of it.
Oh, well, that brings me very, very firmly to the question that I've been thinking. Oh, as you talk about being a theatre maker, it being an entrepreneurial role, and monetizing these sort of things. Best of times, it's difficult to make a living.
It's difficult.
In the times of COVID-19, it's impossible to make a living. One of the industries that's been hardest hit has been the performing arts, which has been an absolute nightmare. I know that Lara Foote is opening the doors of the Baxter very, very gently, and I'm sure the Musambe will follow. How has it been during this lockdown period? I mean, you've been lucky, you've a little baby girl to look after, but how has it been in terms of your self-esteem, that with feelings of self-worth, not being able to do the sort of work that you do? And how do you see the future of theatre under these difficult circumstances?
I think for me, I remember saying earlier in the COVID period in March that I had lost a lot of jobs before COVID just because I was pregnant. So I knew that whatever solution, or in my mind, I'm like, whatever solution we find for how to work under these circumstances will be able to benefit women greatly. So when I talk about developing an entrepreneurial mindset, I think most of the time the conflict has been, are you saying artists must create businesses? And I'm saying, I'm not saying artists must create businesses. We just need to think about our work. Think about it, that it can create potential, that it can... How do I make my work exist in multiple places? platforms. We've seen people like Jefferson Tshabalala. He can create a theater game show, but at the same time, make the language that is used in that game show to create merchandise, you know, where he can write all this and then sell that merchandise with all these quotes from the game show. But at the same time now, he has developed a game, a board game. This came from a theater experience, but it's all about how do I exist in these different platforms. I have imagined 23, a theater play, just being simply a block of ice in an ICA infecting the city festival, and it becomes a durational piece where you just are watching one of the images from the play and analyzing that. And I'm saying, can't we take our work? We take pictures during our performances, and those pictures are usually brilliant because we bring in photographers. Why can't we host an exhibition? You know, why can't we sell these photographs? So I'm not asking people to create businesses necessarily, but I'm just saying your work is providing you with so much to participate in different fields.
That's very out of the box thinking, and I congratulate you on that. I suppose going back to origins and your training and your storytelling, I think the important thing, perhaps in this country specifically, is education. And not just education, the reading and the writing and all the regular curriculum things, but the sort of soul-enriching education. And that seems to me that theatre is a really good use of creating soul-enriching learning.
I think so. I think in terms of really building your confidence, this idea that I matter, this idea of reflection, you know, where I come from, you know, the stories, everything, my experience, it matters. And if I write it down and tell that story, it's a golden thing. It's captured. I think that's important for everyone. Doesn't matter if you're not in the theater. You can share stories with colleagues, with peers. I think it matters to think through and reflect and say it in words. It's your life. And the more I think it, the more I think everything that we do involves storytelling. Everything tells a particular story. And I think having a theater background, it also makes filling in those funding applications much easier, because what story can you tell me in order to get this, you know? And I think the more skilled you are in the storytelling, the more you can participate. But it's important that you learn how to articulate it.
And present yourself well.
Clearly,
you have learned that skill very well.
Thank you, Nancy.
I suppose the big question for everybody at this stage is, what next? With a little baby girl, it's not easy to do a whole lot of things, but do you have another theatre that you're making, another play that you're writing?
I have another play, When We Awake, that was performed early this year, but that one looked at gender-based violence and, you know, navigating it. But I think what's next for me is really, I'm really frustrated with the industry. Yes, I'll be showcasing my work and probably developing work. Or I think the next work that you'll probably be will see, the next new original work, because you can see my old the works that I've created, and we can celebrate that and further develop them. But I think the next work will really engage with formalizing the industry and finding ways to start and maintain a career within the arts. I will find a way to tell that story about this particular journey. I am also the 2020-2021 Mandela Washington Fellow. So that in itself has introduced me to other young people who are young leaders in their industries.
What does that title mean? What will you be doing with that?
I will be collaborating with a whole lot of people that are not in my industry.
From around the world?
From around the world, from around Africa, from around, you know, because the Mandela Washington Fellowship takes about 700 young leaders from African countries. And yes, it's supposed to take them to Washington, D.C., so that they have 6 weeks of intensive training within their particular. It's a fellowship that they divide in 3 parts, public management, civic engagement, and business. And you get mentored on one of those things. And they also try and make you see, you know, how we can foster, you know, the relationships between Africa and the U.S. You just get mentored in a whole lot of things, how to access funding from the U.S., you know, how to analyze what they're doing there and see whether you can develop country-specific ways in South Africa. But I think the great thing about it is also that you're not meeting with artists only. You're meeting with people from various industries facing various problems. But what we have seen is that our problems often intersect. So I know now that in the future, you know, my way to things will always be theatrical or through story, but the outcomes will not always be theatrical, or the outcomes will not always be a play. The outcome might be me mentoring 5 young people in a particular thing and how they start and maintain a career.
Well, whatever's in the future, it certainly sounds very exciting. But I just have to ask you, lastly, we began with Luna. Are you telling her stories now, even young as she is?
I used to. In the first month and second month of her life, I read her bedtime stories. Then the third month became complicated work and schedules and things. I'm telling her less stories now because I pick her up from daycare at like 5:30 and then at 6:30. So I'm really asking her how her day was, and I'm excited to see her, and we're playing and we're bubbling and cooing. And then at 6:30, we're preparing for bedtime, and then she sleeps.
So. I'm sure nonetheless there are going to be many stories in her future.
Definitely many stories. I wrote a lot of letters to her while I was pregnant. I wrote a lot of stories, or, you know, I captured my experience. Even when I was in labor, I was writing. I had a book and a pen because it was during COVID and I had no one around. So I think there are a lot of good stories to tell her.
And I'm sure there'll be a play about that at some stage eventually.
Definitely. So, I mean, one of my friends called me, was like, you know, the Kalanga Blues play I spoke about. In that play, I compare storytelling or creating a play to the process of being pregnant and having a child. So that entire play also archives most of the work that I've done. And each play is called a baby. So throughout the play, you know, plays are babies, and who takes care of these babies, who feeds them. And that's how we're talking about it in that play. And at that period, I was not even pregnant. So he asked me, now that you have a child, is it still the same? Are you still comparing plays to babies? And I said, you know, I think I am. The only difference is that I think we don't give enough attention to our theater babies. Because looking at Luna, you start thinking about the plans for the future of your child. Well, they're still young. And I feel we're not doing that about our plays. You know, with children, you start thinking about the first 1,000 days, because it's believed that those are crucial for shaping the emotional, cognitive, intellectual development, your physical development of your child, the first 1,000 days, the experiences that they get. And I found myself thinking about the first 1,000 days of a theater play. You know, so a whole lot of, you know, raising Luna will certainly teach me about taking care of plays.
Raising Luna sounds like the title of a play already. It seems like there are going to be many, many babies in the future. No, be so wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing
you,
all of that.
Thank
and if
you.
Anybody wants to find you, website?
I don't have a digital home yet. I don't have a website. I'm available on LinkedIn, Nwabisa Plaji. On Facebook, Nwabisa Plaji.
That
Twitter.
Will do. Watch these spaces.
Yeah, watch the spaces.
Nwabisa Plaji, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy.